Hello and welcome to Power Play for this Friday, May 29th. I'm Joyce Napier. Coming up on the show, arrest in Minneapolis.
Former Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin has been charged by the Hennepin County Attorney's Office with murder and with manslaughter.
After days of mass protests, the police officer who knelt on George Floyd's neck is now in police custody, charged with murder. We'll get the latest on this developing story. Then Trump pulls out of the WHO.
We will be today terminating our relationship with the World Health Organization and redirecting those funds to other worldwide and deserving urgent global public health needs.
Several new measures to protect today, America. The U.S. president pulled funding from the World Health Organization and condemned China's malfeasance. And Donald Trump announced he is revoking Hong Kong's special status. This just days after Huawei CFO Meng Wanzhou lost her first legal battle in a Vancouver courtroom. Where does Canada stand amidst the diplomatic turmoil? Foreign Affairs Minister François-Philippe Champagne joins us. And the opposition in Canada's pandemic parliament. The Liberals won a vote this week with the backing of the NDP to suspend parliament until mid-September, meaning COVID-19 is set to halt the normal operations of Canada's House of Commons for 6 months. We'll bring in former Deputy Conservative Leader Lisa Raitt and NDP National Director Anne McGrath on what this means for the opposition in this minority parliament. This is Power Play. Let's get to the players. The Minneapolis police officer who knelt on George Floyd has been charged with third-degree murder and manslaughter. Longtime police officer Derek Chauvin was at the center of the incident, which sparked protests that have spread across the United States after Floyd died while in police custody. Three other officers were involved in the arrest, and protests are calling for them to be charged as well.
I'm not going to speculate today of the other officers. They are under investigation. I anticipate charges, but I'm not going to get into that. Today we're talking about former Officer Chauvin, which we believe has met the standards to be charged, and that's what we have done.
For more on this, CTV's Richard Madden joins us from Washington. Richard, I know that the President of the United States just spoke. What did he say?
Yeah, I mean, look, almost 4 days after this horrific situation unfolded in Minneapolis, the president has largely been silent in public, although he's been tweeting up a storm online. The president was expected to address this and an address to the nation from the Rose Garden earlier this afternoon in a press conference, but he surprisingly walked away without taking reporters' questions, instead talking about China, which you outlined. So, at the top of a meeting with industry executives on reopening the country, the president did address the situation. Take a listen to what he said.
It's a terrible thing. We all saw what we saw, and it's very hard to even conceive of anything other than what we did see. Should never happen, should never be allowed to happen, a thing like that. But we're determined that justice be served. And I spoke to members of the family, terrific people, and we'll be reporting as time goes by. We think that we also have to make the statement, and it's very important that we have peaceful protesters and support the rights.
So President Trump announcing there will be a federal investigation. But as these protests continue to escalate in Minneapolis, the president waded in and ignited a controversy of his own by those pair of tweets that were actually blocked by Twitter, when he said, when the looting starts, the shooting starts. And there's a historical context to that very dark statement. It goes back to the Miami police chief back in the 60s during the civil rights movement, who said, and this police chief was a notorious racist who was targeting African-Americans back then in Florida, and he said the exact same line: when the looting starts, the shooting starts. You have many civil rights activists and many historians who are saying that is racially charged. It is a dog whistle, and it sends a signal, a very bad signal, to those who are exercising the right to protest. So the president did try to walk that back earlier this afternoon, saying it was misquoted. But if anything, it has further ignited and divided the country as opposed to uniting the country, which is typically the role of a president at this time.
Absolutely, being the consoler in chief as well when things like this happen. But so this police officer now has been charged. What has been the reaction to this? Are these protests still ongoing?
Yeah, as far as I know, in Minneapolis, the protests are ongoing. Many of the people there are saying that all those police officers need to be charged, not just the one. But you played earlier the clip from the prosecutor in Minnesota who says those charges, he's expecting to see more charges down the pike, but he does say that the one officer has been charged with third-degree murder. There's been a lot of political reaction urging the president to unite the country. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, a top Republican, has been urging unity in Kentucky today. So, I mean, obviously, race relations has long been a stain in this country, and what we see in Minneapolis it really reflects that.
Are we expecting that there will be more protests as people wait for the other officers to be charged?
Yeah, unclear, but I suspect at least this sends a signal. The police and prosecutors hope this sends a signal that they are taking this horrific tragedy seriously, albeit a few days after it happened. That's what ignited it to begin with. You had concerns, many concerns in the African-American community, that there just is no justice for Black or brown Americans. Whereas if the roles were reversed, if it was a white person who was killed or hurt, that the reaction would be much swifter by police. That's what you're hearing from those protesters in Minneapolis. There were protests all across the country last night. We'll just have to wait and see what transpires in light of these new charges against that police officer.
I want to go back to Donald Trump at the Rose Garden, because it was supposed to be a press conference, which means after a statement, there are questions from reporters, which didn't happen. He spoke about China, talking about China's malfeasance, spoke about the status of Hong Kong, of the World Health
China's
Organization. But then he walked away. What happened then?
Well, then I can tell you all the reporters started shouting questions, asking him, are you not going to address the situation in Minneapolis, or his tweets that really evoke more outrage and division across the country. So, as I mentioned, he is meeting with industry executives at this hour. Perhaps some of the pool reporters will be able to throw questions his way. But it was a real stunning moment when the president didn't take questions. But it also fits a pattern of this president this week. I mean, the other day, he took on social media companies like Twitter after Twitter fact-checked him, one of his tweets. So this is surprise. It's not surprising that the president would ignore the domestic issue at hand. But today, when the White House adjusted the agenda to say there was going to be a press conference, you would think that would mean a press conference where he takes questions from reporters. And as a matter of fact, Joyce, you know, our crew, we were planning to head down to the White House today to attend this press conference in the Rose Garden. But, you know, there's a lot of precautions. They take your temperature. The lineups are much longer than usual to get in. So we decided we better not do it, that we will just watch it from the safety of our bureau here. And I'm so glad that we did that today, because that would have been so incredibly frustrating to go through all those procedures to get inside and then have the president walk away without being able to throw a question to him. It's not surprising, but it is still stunning.
Richard Madden in Washington, D.C., thanks so much for this, and have a good weekend.
You bet.
The clock is ticking on Hong Kong's special trading status. U.S. President Donald Trump announced today that he plans to revoke some of Hong Kong's trade perks as a part of his ongoing rift with China. He says he will issue a travel warning for U.S. citizens, implying Beijing's proposed security law for Hong Kong means U.S. citizens are no longer safe there. Meanwhile, Trump also announced he's severing ties with the World Health Organization, the WHO, blasting the organization's ties to China. Tensions are obviously rising. What does this all mean for the future of the WHO and Hong Kong's special status? And what should Canada's play be? We've asked François-Philippe Champagne for some answers. Foreign Affairs Minister François-Philippe Champagne joins me now from Shawinigan. Minister, so nice to see you. Thanks for being there. I hope you are well. I want to go to, because a few hours ago, the President of the United States made a speech, did not take any questions, but, you know, made a lot of news. So I want to go through that very quickly. So he decided to remove the U.S. status of Hong Kong. It's not sufficiently autonomous, he says. He is going to, you know, revoke Hong Kong's basically status, privileged status, remove trading privileges, and even issue travel advisories to Americans going to Hong Kong. I'd like to get your first reaction on this. Are you surprised or were you expecting this?
Well, first of all, let me say we're deeply concerned. You know, if you step back, the one country two system is what made Hong Kong what is Hong Kong today, which is a big trading and financial hub in Asia. And certainly we are concerned, very concerned, that the imposition by Beijing of a national security law would erode the foundation of that. And certainly what we're doing with our allies, you've seen we made two statements already, but what we're looking with our allies is the implication, the ramifications that decision by Beijing could have on all the arrangements we have with Hong Kong. So we're going to continue to consult with our allies and certainly look at the implication. It's probably too early to tell, but we're certainly going to look at what does that mean specifically for the specific arrangements we have as Canada in place with Hong Kong.
It definitely would have, obviously, an impact on Canada. The United States acted unilaterally, as you are talking with allies to see, and you are making your statements and sending out statements about Hong Kong. Will you issue, because he says it may become dangerous for Americans to travel to Hong Kong, will Canada issue a travel advisory as well?
Well, we will consult with Joyce. At this point of time, we're consulting with allies. You saw that we made a declaration, the most recent one, with the United States, with Australia, with the United Kingdom. We're talking to each other. We're going to have a call on Monday again just to review what could be the implication and ramification of Beijing's decision on Hong Kong. So at this point of time, we are very much in that process of understanding, like I said, very specifically, what could be the ramifications. We'll be talking with our allies. We're going to be acting. We are in touch very much with the United Kingdom, which, as you know, because of the history of Hong Kong, has a vested interest. We do have a vested interest as well in the prosperity and stability of Hong Kong. We have
What the president announced today is definitely going to have an impact on Canada, because not only the Chinese are changing the status of Hong Kong, but America's relationship with Hong Kong is changing, impacting you, the Brits, and everybody else.
Well, as you said, this was just announced. I have not seen the details of the announcement, as you would expect. We're going to be obviously talking about that. I expect to talk to my U.S. counterpart and British counterpart, for that matter, and Australian and New Zealander on Monday. So we'll have a chance to discuss about these issues. It's probably, as you said, this was just announced. So we'll have to understand the implication. But, you know, Canadians, decisions which impact Canadians are taken in Canada by Canadians. So we're going to make our own decision. We're going to review the facts and the implications, like I said, the ramifications of that. This is very much a live issue as we speak. And Canada is at the forefront with our allies with respect to the situation in Hong Kong.
The United States is pulling out. It's what, some $400 million financing or annual financing to the WHO. What is Canada going to do? Are you going to increase your contributions to the WHO?
Well, we said from the beginning that at the appropriate time, and I think the Prime Minister has been very clear, at the appropriate time, we need to ask very hard questions with respect to the leadership, the financing, the alert system when it comes to the World Health Organization. But we believe that in a time of crisis like that, the World Health Organization is the only organization we have today looking, obviously, at this pandemic. And they're playing a very important role in Southeast Asia, in the Caribbean, in the Pacific Islands. So we said we should avoid undermining, obviously, the work that is being done by the World Health Organization now. But the question is, certainly there'll be a time to ask very tough questions, and Canada will be there.
But you would not step in and make up for those $400 million that the Americans are pulling out of the WHO. Would Canada consider increasing its contribution?
Well, we'll see when it comes to the review. But what I can say is that I believe that the best way to shape the institution of the 21st century is to be on the table. I've always believed that engagement is the best way. We realize, I mean, today the Prime Minister was hosting one of the largest events at the United Nations with the Secretary General, the Prime Minister of Jamaica. More than 50 leaders, world leaders, came to that event, which was held yesterday. And this was about how do we think about the system of tomorrow to make sure that we are better prepared for the next crisis, that we reform the system that we have inherited since the Second World War, and that we lead, because that's what citizens around the world expect from countries like Canada, is to lead in the rebuilding of the institution. And the World Health Organization, obviously, is part of that rethinking.
I'd like to go now to the Meng Wanzhou decision. You know, the Chinese, even before the decision came down, the foreign affairs spokesman in Beijing issued a warning to Canada. The state-run media called Canada a pathetic clown and a scapegoat in the fight between China and the U.S. When we see the decision, when we know that this case is going to live before the Canadian courts for a long, long time, two names come to mind, the two Michaels, Michael Kovrig and Michael Spavor. What do you think is going to happen to them? And is there anything you can do to make their lives easier right now?
Well, certainly. First, it's a time for restraint. And the second thing is that we have said all along, we have been very transparent with the Chinese counterpart, that our judicial process is independent. This is an independent decision by a court in British Columbia. And the benefit, one of the benefit of an independent judiciary is that you don't need to explain, you don't need to justify, you don't need to excuse yourself by a court decision. A court decision is a court decision, full stop. So we're going to be, I've been engaging with my counterpart in China. We hope to have a call within the coming days. This is a time for restraint. This is a time for what I've called responsible engagement. We are engaging with China wide open, with eyes wide open, and certainly we're going to continue, as we have done from day one. My first and foremost priority is to obtain the release of Michael Kovrig, Michael Spavor, to get clemency for Mr. Schellenberg and all the other Canadians which are facing death penalty. And I've said from the beginning, what you need now is principled and smart engagement when it comes to China. That's the policy we have pursued. The decision in the Meng case was on a motion. The judicial process is going to continue. But as far as I'm concerned,
as long as you know that as long as this judicial process continues, and to the Chinese, it is a very political process, and you can understand, I'm going to play devil's advocate here. After she was arrested at the request of the Americans who asked for an extradition, the president of the United States said, mused that he would, maybe drop the extradition request if he could get a trade deal with China. Now China is accusing Canada of being complicit with the United States and of wanting to harm Huawei. As the months go by, this relationship gets even more tangled, and these two men are caught in the middle. And you said restraint is now, but you have been restrained so far. They've been in jail for over 530 days. Isn't it time now to be less restrained?
Well, I would say at this time where, we had this this decision which came out, what I was saying, what I've said to the Chinese counterpart is for them to be restrained when it comes to, because we said that in Canada, the judicial is independent. That's one of the great benefits of our country. We believe in the rule of law. And I would say, Joyce, let's make a big distinction. The Meng case is a case where Canada is applying an extradition treaty where the defendant is provided with due process, has the benefit to go in front of an independent judge. We make independent decision. When you look at the case of Michael Kovrig and Michael Spavor, you're talking about two Canadians which have been arbitrarily detained for more than 500 days. That's 500 days too much. These gentlemen are arbitrarily detained. It is very different. We have said that to the Chinese counterpart. And I would say, Joyce, smart and principled engagement is not weak. That's the smart thing to do in the circumstances, because we need to keep in mind that our first and foremost priority is to get the release of the Michael. We have engaged the international community. I have had a chance to raise that issue with my Chinese counterpart at every time we had a chance to engage. We have asked that they be granted virtual consular assistance, or that we be provided a virtual consular access in accordance with the Vienna Convention. And we will continue to stand up, speak up for their release, and gather the international community behind us.
And the Meng Wanzhou decision this week does not make this any easier for you or for the two Michaels. François-Philippe Champagne, thanks so much for taking the time to talk to us.
Thank you very much for having me.
And we're going to take you now to St. Paul, Minnesota, where the police are holding a press conference. They are expected to address the recent protests and looting following George Floyd's death Monday while in Minneapolis police custody. Let's listen in.
I have signed an emergency order declaring a state of local emergency around this situation in St. Paul right now, and also establishing a citywide curfew that will start at 8 o'clock p.m. tonight and that will continue until 6 a.m. tomorrow morning. This order exempts members of the media, and it exempts workers returning home from a work shift. Other than that, we are asking our community to stay home so that we can ensure that we can protect that basic life, health, and safety mission of our community. We've hosted digital roundtables today, engaging members of our community, members of our communities of color, business owners and business leaders in our community. And we're actually, as we speak, convening a roundtable of faith leaders in our community. All told, we've engaged over 400 different members of our community in this conversation digitally, and we're going to continue to do that. I have also worked with members of our faith community and challenged us to together announce and convene a citywide interfaith unity hour of prayer in the first hour of our...
That was the mayor of St. Paul, Minnesota, saying there will be a curfew in the city. Coming up, without a full parliamentary sitting, is government oversight all but over? Are the Liberals on a free ride until the pandemic ends? A special panel with two high-profile NDP and Conservative analysts weigh in after the break. And welcome back. Parliament is essentially out of commission. A Liberal proposal backed by the NDP passed this week decided the fate of the so-called pandemic parliament. In a nutshell, the special COVID-19 committee meetings will continue, but we won't see a full parliamentary sitting until at least September. Our opposition parties at a unique disadvantage, although the NDP will this agree to it. Will this limit the government oversight? We have a special panel here to discuss. Anne McGrath is the NDP National Director, and Lisa Raitt is the former Deputy Conservative Party leader and CTV News political analyst. Hello to both of you. Welcome to Power Play. You know, so I want to start with this. So MPs are limited in their powers, no opposition days. They can't introduce private members' bills. Are you concerned, both of you, of your party's ability to hold the government to account? I'm going to start with you, Lisa Raitt. Are you concerned that the Liberals are getting a free ride?
Sure, I'm concerned. And I'm concerned not just for the parties. I'm concerned for Canadians, because I do believe that there should be some oversight as to all the spending and the decision-making that is being made by this government. I also think it's unfair, Joyce, that the Prime Minister every day has announcements that he makes that he is not questioned on by members of the opposition, nor is there a deep dive into what the programs are that he's actually introducing at that time. I think it's a big mistake for the parties that agreed to let go of Parliament for the summer to do so. And I think it's one that's going to be seen in the future to be the wrong move.
But Anna, I want to ask you that because it seems that, you know, the NDP backed the proposal in exchange for a deal on paid sick leave. But aren't you worried that you've relinquished, you know, sort of every opposition party's power to oversee the governing Liberals?
Well, a couple of things here, Joyce. First of all, the committee of the whole, the special COVID committee, did sit this week, and there was very robust questioning of the government during the sittings that happened this week that will continue on for the next several weeks and that will also happen in the summertime leading into the September resumption of Parliament. The other thing is that the Liberals had wanted to have this hybrid model only 3 days a week. The Conservatives wanted a kind of a full return, but with only a limited number of parliamentarians. So there were problems with a couple of those. We were able to get the 4 days a week, which I think is important. But also the conservative model, unfortunately, I think would have really created problems for any MPs that were not kind of within close enough distance to Ottawa to be able to participate. So this way, all MPs can participate because it is this hybrid model. All MPs can participate. It is focused on the issues that are front and center in the country right now and on really pushing the Liberal government to make announcements that will actually meet the needs of everyone, not just these small little niche announcements, but that they will actually expand what they're doing so that everybody gets protection during this period of time.
So, Lisa, do you agree with that, that this committee of the whole is just as good as the, you know, usual Parliament sitting with MPs being able to, you know, private members' bills and all the other things that you're allowed to do that you can't do anymore? So is this good enough?
Well, I don't know if it's good enough, and I can't fault Anne and the parties for trying to come up with something that works, given that MPs want to take part. But what I can say is this, what we've ended up with is a system where there's no questions on the order paper and that there's no ability to do private members' bills, which is a big difficulty because they're two powerful tools for the opposition. And I also would note that I think even the president of the Treasury Board is a little bit concerned. He wrote his colleagues this week and he said to them, by the way, make sure you're being transparent and fulfilling all the things that you have to fulfill under access to information and that you have all your systems in place. Obviously, there's concern that there's going to be appropriate tracking. Having an opposition in place to be able to deal with governmental operations, which is separate from COVID-19 issues, I think is important. And we are going to lose that in this process.
You know, what I'm interested in is, you know, perhaps journalists are a little bit outraged. And, you know, obviously the opposition is, but that is your job. But it doesn't seem to have, you know, resonated with the public. It's sort of like, it fell flat. Do you understand why people don't seem to care? I'll go with you, to you, Anne. Why aren't people thinking, hey, if the Japanese can do it because their house is sitting, they have, a very sort of passionate debates with masks on, why can't we do that?
Well, I think it is true that it is not front and center. It is never really front and center in people's minds what's happening in Parliament unless it's something really, really specific. What is on people's minds right now, primarily, is that we're in a pandemic. A lot of our economy has been shut down. People are sick and are dying. And we have a scandal that is finally coming to light in a way that people are paying attention in the long-term care sector. So there's a lot on people's minds. They're very worried about how the recovery proceeds, what kind of normal we're going to go into, what things we're going to keep from before and what things are going to have to go, what the new normal looks like. I think that's what's on people's minds, not some kind of discussion of the arcane rules of Parliament. They see that they will see that this week and continuing on that that MPs are in the House and participating virtually, asking questions. They'll also see the opposition has many of the things that Lisa mentioned are very important, like opposition days and so forth. But another place where opposition really has a lot of opportunity in a minority parliament is in committees. And we have been able to get several committees back up and running and added a few committees this week through the negotiations. So committees are another place where some of this happens. But by and large, what the public cares about is is the public health and the economy.
Oh, I don't have a lot of time, but Lisa, I want to give you a chance to respond to this, because we people are concerned also about government spending, the government is not giving us a fiscal update. So are people not concerned with that?
I think people are exhausted. I think people are hearing lots of information come their way. They're worried if they're going to have a job. They're worried about if they're going to have money. I agree with Anne. That's front and center. Health is front and center for folks. That's why it's even more important to have that dedicated group of people, the opposition, there to take up the democratic charge that they need to take up. And what we saw happen in the House this week was that was taken away and it was diluted. Okay. And that's what I have a problem with. It should be there.
Anne McGrath and Lisa Raitt, as always, fascinating to talk to you. Thanks so much and have a great weekend.
Thanks,
Joyce.
And that's your Power Play Day in Politics. Thank you for choosing to be here with us today. We're going to take you back to our Toronto newsroom for the latest on today's top stories.